Empire Podcast this week, Viggo Mortensen and Noel Clarke join our fellowship, one of them literally, as you'll see. Plus usual news and nonsense in the movie podcast. I didn't have time to write an intro this morning because we were too busy counting the number of people Jack Reacher kills in Gone Tomorrow. True story.
Is that right?
True story. Gotta have a hobby. Answer's 8, by the way. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, sponsored by those high flyers at American Airlines, the world's largest airline. With two flights a day from Heathrow to LAX on its new planes, American Airlines is the preferred airline of the entertainment industry. And with 260 movies and 240 TV shows available on demand on board, that's enough content to fly around the world. We've checked this 26 times. So give it a go. Give it a go. It's the best way to catch up on American Horror Story. All 6 of them. And of course, American Airlines are not just sponsoring this podcast. No. They've really taken off. See what I did there? By becoming the headline sponsor of Empire Live, our incredibly exciting entertainment extravaganza, which is coming to the O2 London from September 23rd to 25th. More to come on that one later, but tickets are available on empirelive.com. Okay, this week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Say hello to Phil Dissemblian, art house guru.
Yeah, hi.
And Johnny Pyle.
Hello.
And for the first time ever, really excited about this. Delighted to say that one of our guests this week will actually be joining us for most of the show. So don't think of him as the star, writer and director of Brotherhood. Think of him as part of the Pod team. Noel Clarke. Hello, sir.
Hello, sir. Thank you for having me, guys.
No, we're delighted to have you. Not least because you were meant to be on last week's show and we somehow deleted the interview.
Deleted the whole farm. Yeah.
Which is only the third time it's happened in podcast history.
In podcast history, yeah. You know, I always like to think there's some sort of conspiracy, so but because it's you, I believe there isn't. You know.
It's general incompetence.
No, yeah.
It seems more credible.
Yeah, because it's you, I think it's just incompetence, actually.
I accidentally pressed a big red button.
Yeah.
What is this?
The
do?
One that said, do not press.
Do not press this big red button.
Yeah, I thought it was that one.
But how are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm good. I'm sort of basking a little bit in the reflective glow of box office success.
I know. It's a good thing actually that you're back in, because obviously Brotherhood opened over the weekend and did gangbusters.
Yeah, it did very well. I think a lot of people didn't quite expect it, you know, with the genre being dead and everything, you know, exploited to death by a company that shall remain nameless and having been dead for some time.
You can Google that company's name if you want to.
Yeah. Rhymes with Slivolva. You know, now, obviously, it's not that I'm trying to revive it. I was just making the film that I thought I needed to make at this part of my life, the age I'm at.
8 years down the line.
8 years down
from
the line,
adulthood.
Three kids later. You know, fatter, balder.
The time was right.
Yeah, it was just right.
But why Brotherhood? Why not Fatherhood, for example?
Because it's a... Can I swear on this podcast?
Of course you can.
Oh, because it's a shit name. And it reminds me of a Steve Martin film. And I just felt like he would turn up in the movie, and I didn't want that.
And there's a double act.
Brotherhood still kind of has like a, yo, it's Brotherhood. You know, can you imagine? Oh, I'm a gangster, Fatherhood. No, not quite, mate.
So the film opened last week and made 2 million quid, roughly.
2 million, yeah. We did have previews.
Rounded up.
Yeah, we had previews. Yeah, it was 1.98 something, so it was like 2 million.
It's rounded up,
isn't it? You know, I'm sure the head of Lionsgate could have thrown in an extra 20 and topped it up if he wanted to. And we had previews, but Sausage Party, who was 2.7, and on double the amount of screens, they had previews too. So, you know, I think it's fair game.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's not bad at all.
So, are you rolling in cash this week? How much of it goes directly to you?
I wish that, you know, we actually got like a pound for every, you know.
For every pound you made.
Sorry, a penny for every pound. I'd be all right. But unfortunately, as you know, in the film industry, it doesn't work that way. So, you know, I'm sure the investors and distributors will be rubbing their hands. But there's a labyrinth of a waterfall before I start seeing anything.
So it'll be, what, 15 years and you'll get a royalty check for £25?
Yeah. Well, you know, weirdly, because the budget's so low on this and it's doing so well, it might not be 15, it might be 5, but then they'll start trickling in. I'll get like a check for 2p and be like, yes!
But it's amazing because in 1 week it made two-thirds of what Adulthood made.
Yeah,
in,
and it's still climbing. We're doing about 150 a night. So, I mean, they're thinking now it might be Adulthood, which would be nice.
That's amazing. Yeah. So clearly there was an appetite there for... Do you think it was an appetite there for this type of film, or an appetite for the return of Sam, your character, or what was it?
It's a combination of things, you know. It really is a combination of things, you know, because I've tried to work it out in the past myself. You know, I went on after Adulthood and did sci-fis and did stuff like that. And you take yourself as the leading man that's had so much success and you put yourself in these other films and they don't quite have the success, and you start to realise, okay, it's not just that. And then other people exploit these genres and they don't have the success, and you realise it's the combination. It's like they want that character, they want me in that type of film. And you kind of, there's a certain audience that go, okay, he's great, but do I want to see him fighting aliens? No, I can watch that on TV. I love these types of films, but where are my core characters that I grew up with at school? But when you put those things together,
yeah,
it suddenly works. Like, I would be sure that Brotherhood would have still done business had I even not been in it.
Yeah.
If I'd just written it. But the fact that it's Sam and the, you know, it's a combination.
Yeah. Was there a period, though, when you were maybe fighting against that perception that, you know, that if you were in a movie like this, it would do really well? I mean, because it took 8 years from Adulthood to Brotherhood.
It did take it. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's the same with, like, American stars when they do a certain film and then suddenly you put them in a rom-com or something and it just bombs.
Mm.
And then everyone goes, okay, they like him in action movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of those ones. But it's trial and error. You don't always know that stuff until you do it. And I think I have, because some of the others, the sci-fis, have done well abroad, I think I've half transcended it, but there's a core audience here that grew up on those films that then go, when other films like that come out, then go, well, they're serial O's, they're not the brand name ones.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they want the brand name ones with the elements and the they want the Happy Meal with the proper toys in it. Not the Smiley Meal from McDougal's. That doesn't exist, by the way.
I love the Smiley Meal.
Other burger places are available.
I do love McDougal's. It's my favourite burger
joint. Smiley Meal, right?
Yeah. Just look at me, man. Look at the size of me. Right. So we'll talk to you more as the show progresses. But we have readers' questions, or one reader's question, which has been sent in via Twitter, Josie, this week, by at Connor Keneally. And this is a cracking question. How are you and Tom Hanks?
I love Hanks.
Yeah, good. Love okay, Hanks-y. Good.
You have a favourite Tom Hanks character?
Woody.
Okay.
Everyone loves a Woody. Right. If all of Tom Hanks's characters had a fight, who do you think would win? That is a high level, high end, high concept question. Who would win in a fight between Tom Hanks's characters?
This is a very, very, very good question.
Do you have an answer?
No. Johnny's got some thoughts, though. Do you want to lead off?
Well, I had some thoughts about weapons. Are there any of his detectives or his Captain Miller from Saving Private Ryan would be carrying guns?
Yeah.
So presumably he's going to be, say, Joe Fox from You Got Mail.
Yeah.
Because they just shoot him.
Yeah. Mm.
That's true. But Miller has, you know, he has slightly...
He has morals.
He's got morals, but also he sometimes shakes in action, so... Mm. I'd put him up against Joe Miller.
Was Road to Perdition a Hanks movie?
Yes, that's a good call.
So he's got a gun in that.
Yeah.
He's like a proper gangster enforcer. He's a mob enforcer, isn't he? So he's probably likely to have... But are we talking about a fight with weapons, though? Or just a sort of...
Yeah, like a full Anchorman style... I mean, this isn't in the question, I'm just extrapolating here, but just a full Anchorman style, dust up in a car park, 3 a.m, all of Hanks' characters got absolutely pissed up and they're just going for it.
I've picked mine.
Okay, what is it?
It's the Castaway guy.
The Castaway guy? Chuck Nolan.
He survived a plane crash, he talks to a ball, like, you cannot mess with that.
Handy
thing,
with the blade, right?
Like, he talks to a ball, man, like, he is nuts. You can't be, you'd be like, aiming a gun at him and he'd just be like, with his beard and stuff. You can't beat him.
That wouldn't stop a bullet, though, would it?
He survived a plane crash, man. He can survive pretty much anything.
He takes out his own molar with an ice skate, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Guys, you're right. He's got...
He's hardcore.
He's hardcore.
He'd be aiming guns at him and he'd be camouflaged and disappeared, like you wouldn't be able to see him.
But I'm going to one-up you on that, Noel. The conductor from Polar Express.
Oh, Christ.
Dead eyes. Look right into your soul. Doll's eyes. He's going to go his psychological advantage.
You just hear that flipping bell.
Yeah. Terrifying man. You mentioned Joe versus the volcano.
I did, and we were discussing beforehand exactly what happens in Joe versus the volcano.
Right.
Because presumably he fights a volcano.
Neither of us know is the key here. Like, we haven't seen it.
Have you never seen Joe versus the volcano?
No, but we think he wins.
Good film. He wins.
We think he fights a volcano and beats the volcano, and therefore would beat any of these other people. David Basner, for example, or... Josh Baskin.
Victor Navorsky from The Terminal.
Yeah.
Adaptable.
But a bit rubbish.
Good in confined spaces.
A bit rubbish.
Sleeps in the bin.
The thing is, he's never really played. I mean, he's played one Killing Machine in Road to Perdition. I don't know. I'd have to put that guy up against the Castaway guy. You've got a Tommy gun versus a guy with a folly ball.
But you can't see him because he's like crazy and he hides.
Are you confusing him with the Predator?
No, he's as good as, man. You know, he's
Tom Hanks as the Predator would be.
And also, does Woody count in this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dude, because if you saw a little crazy toy walking towards you, wouldn't you just freak out? Remember when his head turns around and Parkman says, so plain nice. Remember that?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
You got Road to Perdition's got nothing on that, man. He'd freak out.
All right. Okay.
I think I might have the answer, though. If you've seen Cloud Atlas, he plays a Cockney gangster called Dermot Hoggins.
Mm.
He plays five characters.
Five, yeah.
I think. Or is it six? This is the film where Hugh Grant plays a Maori cannibal.
Yeah.
And they put Tom Hanks
naturally, it's a role he was waiting to play all his life.
And he throws a bloke off a roof.
Yeah.
I think he's probably the most likely to win a sort of fist fight, I'd imagine.
I don't know. I'm still going with the guy with the Tommy gun. I mean, Forrest Gump can run. He's pretty fast, and he's handy with a ping-pong bat. But you cannot run a bullet, or a folly of bullets. So.
Does this come down to, like, a Street Fighter 2 thing, which is, like, there are heavier characters who are slower moving, which is, like, Hanks in his later career. And then there's, like, the more live but quicker characters that are, you know, 80s Tom Hanks. And then it comes down to just what your personal preference is and, like, what plays to your strengths as your... So for myself, I would probably pick a lither character with the speed and
someone nimble, like
yeah. So I think I'm leaning towards 80s, mm-hmm. and I'm going to let the yeah later Tom Hanks has the weight, he comes second best for me for that.
What about the finishing moves of the later Tom Hanks characters? I mean, you know, I quite like the idea of having a sort of Street Fighter 2 scenario instead of this free for all. There I can see Chuck Norland.
Then I have a new option. Big. Tom Hanks in Big.
Tom Hanks in Big.
Because you can turn to a little boy and a grown adult and you'd be like, who's this little boy? And you'd be like, oh, hello, little boy. And he'd be like, and he'd grow up and just like get you.
He's got the knife skills of an adult, but the face of a child.
Well, you wouldn't expect it.
That's
suddenly
a really
bang.
Good point.
Hey, so little boy, I'm just going to put my gun down and give you some candy.
So in this scenario that we've created, do these Tom Hanks characters know they're all played by Tom Hanks? Do they know that they're fighting themselves? Or is it literally just, you know...
I mean, they're surprised they all look the same, but otherwise they don't realise why.
Chuck from Castaway sees Josh from Big and they just...
They're like,
what?
Familiarity.
Okay.
I'm going to kill you anyway.
All right, okay, good. I'm glad we've set up the rules of this, otherwise...
Well, but you wouldn't
just...
kill a little boy, would you? Oh, no. Zoltan. Grow me, Zoltan.
I don't remember being able to change.
well, hey, he changed, didn't he? He wished it. So who's to say that after Big finish, that didn't continue?
Can you write a remake of Big? Because I would genuinely love to see that.
Just changes that will.
It's amazing. I think we've answered our question definitively, haven't we?
We've listed every single Tom Hanks character.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's an answer. What do you think? Are we saying...
Personally, I like the Road to Perdition guy, whose name I've completely blanked on, but I'm looking it up on Google right now. Michael Sullivan, there we go, that's his name. That's my choice. Knowles is Woody, because, yeah, how are you going to beat a toy? It's almost impossible.
Because he could even trick the kid.
Yeah, there you go.
Johnny? Joe Banks, Joe vs. Volcano.
Because he's got a volcano.
Probably... The conductor from Polar Express.
Because of his cold, dead, lifeless eyes.
Should we do a poll on Twitter and see what people think?
That's a great idea. We're going to do a poll on Twitter and get the public to put this to the vote, and then we're going to get Tom Hanks to recreate this one day.
He probably would.
That'll be his next movie. Right. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, and why the hell wouldn't you after that? We're on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. You can use the hashtag Empire Podcast. In fact, please use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And we're on email at podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, this time in the show is usually when we have a guest, a pre-recorded guest. But this time, obviously, Noel is here. He's live.
Hello.
He's live in the studio. So I'm going to talk to Noel for a few more minutes. Your credit in Brotherhood intrigued me. Because it's and Noel Clark at the end.
Yes.
But you're the lead of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting to me. Why did you do that?
I did that in adulthood too.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm doing so much in the film anyway. Give some of the other actors like the lead, the top billing. It kind of doesn't bother me. I've never had that sort of ego that I needed to be top billing.
Yeah,
I don't care.
Yeah.
So I think I gave it to Arnold this time. Uh-huh. I don't remember who I gave it to in adulthood, and I just go at the end because it's going to say written and directed by anyway, so I don't need to written and directed and star. It's ridiculous.
Produced by T-Buy, all sorts of stuff.
Tea, coffee made by. Yeah, it's ridiculous. So yeah, I always put it at the back. I don't really care.
That's refreshing. I like that.
I work with people I like, and they're good guys. I mean, I worked with Arnold for so long, and I've so I don't care about that sort of stuff.
It is interesting as well, because watching the movie, knowing it was the last, and I don't want to give anything away here for the people who haven't seen it yet, but knowing it's the last in the series, seeing you come at the end and Noel Clarke, and it's a thriller as well, in which Sam is imperiled throughout, gives it an extra frisson, I think. I think audiences look at that, when you see someone and...
Yeah.
You expect them to maybe not stick around as long as someone who would come up at the very, very beginning of the credits.
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really think of it like that. It's just a case of, when you're doing deals with actors and there's someone you like and the agent says, what's the billing going to be? And you just go, oh, they can have fight first. And they're just like, are you sure? I'll fax over the paperwork now. Email or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I don't care about that, man. I think actually it's quite nice because, like you said, at the end of the story, to have that at the end kind of also makes sense in a way because, I created it. But I just kind of don't mind doing it.
When you sat down, what was it now, 12, 13 years ago, more, with Kittlehood?
Yeah.
And you created this character who initially, of course, in Kittlehood is...
One-dimensional bully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And very much the villain of the piece.
Yeah.
Did you have any ideas for him down the line? Did you know?
No.
The way you turned him around over the course of the next two movies is really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, and I never had any ideas to do that. I mean, the thing really was play that part to the best of my ability because I was too old to play the lead, which is what I originally wanted. But by the time I'd written it so many years before, by the time it got made, I was too old to play Trevor. Mm-hmm. So play that part, and that was it. I just played it. And I did kind of afterwards, when I got a bit older and started thinking about him, think, oh, it's a bit one-dimensional. And then when the next film came up, because I'd written it on spec, just... had an idea and wrote it, Trevor couldn't be in there, and I just kind of thought I really wanted people to understand more about why a guy would behave like that. And so my idea was to turn the two characters that people really disliked into characters that people liked and see if I could manipulate an audience with my writing. And so it was supposed to be Sam and Becky. And then Jamie couldn't do it, so I rewrote that part into her cousin Lexi, who's as you see, this sort of off-kilter girl, and but I think by the end people are rooting for them. When he stands at the door of adulthood at the end and he just walks in, I think people are like, oh my god, they're gonna be together. And as you can see from, again without giving too much away, as you can see from this film at the start when he's got the two children, you clearly see they did stay together for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And what was your intention with Sam this time around? Because it's partially a redemption story.
Yeah,
but as you said last time we spoke, you also covered that in Adulthood.
Yeah, I think Adulthood was more the redemption story. I think this one is sort of a, weirdly, even though he's older, sort of he's coming of age, of this middle age. He's coming of middle age and kind of realizing that, the things you do when you're young really affect you. Like, you can't. It's so strange. It's all fun and games when you're young. Or not fun and games. Some people are really put upon and bullied, like the kids in the movie. But or Arnold's character got bricked in adulthood.
Yeah.
And it affects him 10 years later. It still affects him. And I kind of wanted people to realise that the things you do in your past, with Sam, it happens to be something he did that causes people to, want revenge on him. But the things you do in your past really affect you. And it's kind of... he comes of age in this film, he realises what's important, and just as he realises what's important in terms of family, because he's still flawed, you know, he meets the Greek girl, and I won't give it away, but I mean, he's a flawed guy, he always has been, but just as he starts to realise what's important, those things start getting taken away, and it's like, it comes down to anyone who's got a mother, sister, brother that they desperately love, even friends sometimes, it comes down to what you would do to protect your family and friends. That's kind of where he's at, because he flippantly is like, oh, meet this chick and do this, and I'm trying my best, but are you really? And then some things start happening to your family, and sometimes that stuff can galvanize you, and you're like, it just so happens in this film it's more violence related and stuff like that. But in real life, you know, sometimes people don't talk to family members for a long time. Something happens and then all the family's galvanized or something. It's too late. Yeah. Like, come on, man. That was your brother or your sister or your...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of about that, really.
Oh, I was just going to ask about the way that the West London of the film series has changed since you started making this.
Yeah.
Because it has, hasn't it? A lot.
Yeah, it has a lot. I mean, it's gentrification, man.
How does that affect the sort of the backdrop for the movie for you?
In different ways. I mean, you know, you see Sam coming out of Starbucks and stuff like that, and, you know, the three films really show the gentrification of the area, but also of the character. I mean, like, his missus is a lawyer. They have a place, you know, so he's not like where he used to be. And I think these films, and the reason this one took so long, is these films always come from a place of truth when I write them. You know, I can write everything I was saying in my head, but these things always come from a place of truth. And in the years that I've been doing this business and gone from council estate to having a little one bedroom when I was shooting out of Edith's Impet to now having three bedrooms and a garden and three children and looking after them, is like, I've seen both sides of that area. I live in the same borough. I've never left that borough. You know, you tell people now, they're like, ooh, la-di-da, Kensington and Chelsea. But mate, when I grew up in Ladbroke Grove, it was not fun.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a place that you like, la-di-da. People were like, oh my God, you're from Ladbroke Grove. Just in the north of the borough. Now I live in the south of the borough. But the point is, it's like, I've seen both sides. Both sides of that. Literally, you know, at the premiere party, after party, you know, the head of lines gets sitting there and I'm talking to him and I said, oh, this is my friend Steve, and Steve's a banker. You know, I still even this. This is my friend such and such. I won't say his name. And yeah, he served 12, got sentenced 25 and served 12. And oh, hello. how are? But that's I've seen both sides of that area. And so for me, the character is just there. He's just integrated. He doesn't look at it. Now, you see it on screen, but he doesn't look at it that way. It's just, you just see it. It's a bit more posh and, you know.
You've seen both sides of the sort of filmmaking process as well. I mean, when you came on the podcast to talk about Storage 24, you were on the cusp of Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume you weren't on the set for a long, long time with that one.
I was.
Were you?
Weirdly, yeah.
How long were you, how many days shooting?
I think 10 days shooting, 8 minutes of in the film, 10 days shooting, but I was in LA for like 4 months.
Yeah,
you know, you can go. You know, you can go down and hang out, and that was the best learning experience, to sit there and watch that guy.
I was wondering, like, what you've brought back from that to your own filmmaking and film writing.
Everything, like, I don't read reviews or anything like that, but sometimes I look at what people say about the filmmaking, and I can literally look at this one. If people go, "This is not a well-made film," then I'll shit on them. Like, that's bullshit.
Right.
Like, Adulthood's not a well-made film because I didn't know what I was doing. I was lucky enough to get the opportunity, and I was nowhere, I wasn't taking it. The story's great, and people can look at the visceral thing and, oh, it's so raw, because he doesn't know, and it's brilliant in that regard. But you look at it, you know, I can watch it now. It's not a well-made film. It's just me learning and going, all right, I'll have a montage here, I'll put that there. Brotherhood's a well-made film. Like, I don't care what you think about the story. I don't care whether you give it 1 star, 5 stars. That's a well-made film. Like, for the budget we had, it's slick. It's cinematic. I know what I'm doing now. And so for me, you know, that sort of stuff's important. And I took everything from that. You can do nothing but learn from a man like J.J. Abrams in every way, shape or form. You know, and I'm pretty easygoing, actually. Always have been. But seeing him on set as well, and just how he deals with everything, and how he kind of really deals with crew and actors and remembers people's names and stuff like that, it was just reinforced the way that I was already behaving, already what I was doing. But anything, I was like, man, you know, he didn't even get upset there, okay?
Yeah.
You need to kind of not get as upset as you might have done, you know, because you're watching one of the best.
Yeah.
If he's at the top of the Champions League and this is how he behaves, creates a happy crew, you know?
Yeah.
And so I took everything from that.
Is that what you were like initially as a director? Were you someone who got angry with people if they didn't deliver?
No, not really. I was never like that anyway. Like I said, I didn't really get like that anyway, but you can get frustrated. But his frustration is more like, whereas my frustration is like, Fur! Do you know what I mean? And it's just about, realizing, much like in here, I doubt anybody's in here just coasting along. I'm hoping.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is trying their best. And you always have to remember that. And sometimes when you've got 15 different departments, sometimes it's, And you need the costume, and they're like, oh, we haven't bought it, it's back at base. And you kind of want to go over, but you just go, you know what? it'll be fine. Someone get it, and we'll just wait. Let's think about what we can. And it's just different ways of handling things.
Yeah. As a director, can you see in JJ those moments? You know, when you're feeling those things, you know, and he's probably trying to keep them to himself.
Yeah, you can see it though. You can see it, but he deals with it in such a, doesn't make anyone ever feel like, you know, things happen. Yeah. Mistakes happen. So like, it's not a big deal, is it? Do you know what I mean?
People got really upset about the whole John Harrison Khan thing in that movie. I don't know how aware you were of that. You know, the audiences have relationships with characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine you have that with the Brotherhood and the Adulthood series as well. People get very attached to the characters.
Yeah, they do. They do, yeah. But I think a testament to this film is that nobody was missed. Let's put it that way.
I just wanted to follow that up. Did you talk to Benedict about that whole thing on set? Did you get a chance to chat to him?
I was with him.
Yeah.
All my scenes are with him, I think. And then we spoke, obviously, outside of work. And, yeah, I mean, he didn't
register particularly.
He had to do his job, man. Like, he didn't write it or anything. Yeah. Like, he's really kind of, like, at the time was just like, man, I can't believe I'm doing it. I'm happy to do this movie. I was like, me too.
Yeah.
You know, so that was that, really.
Yeah.
You've obviously stayed, as you say, in the place where you've lived all your life. You've stayed in Britain. You haven't gone to LA.
Yeah.
I mean, you obviously shot Star Trek Into Darkness in LA, but have you ever been tempted to go out there and do that thing where you're out there for a year, 2 years? And
I haven't really been tempted, much to the chagrin of many agents I've had out there, because they're always like, come to pilot season and, you know, get a pilot and stay in it for 7 years, 23 episodes a year for 10 months. And I'm like, that ain't happening, man. That's not happening. So I've moved a few agents at times. No, I'm not massively tempted. I mean, I love that country. I don't like elements of the country. Like, I don't want to be dropping my kids off at school and worried about them getting shot up and stuff like that. There's things I can't quite deal with. And I know that doesn't happen, but it happens enough.
Yeah.
It happens too much. And I think nowadays most people go on tape anyway, so it almost doesn't matter. It almost doesn't matter where you are. Sometimes it's better to be in the room, but I've never been tempted. It's never called to me. I've always felt like if I work hard enough, I'll get there, like I did with Star Trek. You know? And then, you know, I create my own work, so it's never something that kind of is, I need to do this. And I love raising my kids. I enjoy like raising my kids, and I wouldn't want to move the whole family, and then I wouldn't want to be away from them for like months and months at a time.
Yeah.
If the right thing came along, the right thing, and the role's big enough, and I'm not talking about continuing like 7 year thing, but if the right thing came along, then 100% there's a consideration. You know, you get stuff like a True Detective, or, you know, those 6-parters that it's only going to be a couple of months, not 10.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if the right thing came along, then I would always consider anything, you know.
Yeah. But otherwise, it seems like there's a commitment. I mean, there are a number of directors who, because, you know, you get British directors and they make films, and then Hollywood comes and they go to Hollywood. But there seems to be a growing number of directors who stay here, and they stay here and they support a film industry that frankly needs support.
Yeah.
You know, people like Ben Wheatley and Paddy Considine.
He emailed me yesterday to congratulate
on the
numbers and stuff like that.
Yeah. So this is clearly a decision on your part to stay here and make British films and stay within the industry.
I would make an American film.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some on the table, but the first part of it is correct. It's clearly a decision. There is a decision to stay here.
Yeah.
Make an American film. I'd 100% make an American film. Like, that's not without a shadow of a doubt. We've got about 5 on our slate that I would do in a heartbeat that we're building up and setting up and stuff like that. So that's not really what it's about. I think the key is being a British director that can make either British films or American films.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so the second part is a choice to stay here.
What's the next film?
I can't necessarily tell you that. I've chosen the
what
next.
What does it rhyme with, Noel?
The next one I want to direct rhymes with booger.
Ooh.
There you go.
Okay.
How many words are there that rhyme with booger?
I'm lost.
Yeah,
booger. Booger rhymes with booger.
We do. So we produced Scottish Muscle, which is Tallulah Riley's writing directing debut.
Oh yeah.
Which we set up and produced at Unstoppable, which is my company. So that's coming out at the end of September.
Cool.
Couldn't be further from a hood film.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a person of colour in it, if I'm honest. There's an otter.
Ray the Otter, or just an otter?
No, I think we called him Ray. We did call him Ray the Otter. No. There's an otter, and so that's coming out, and setting up a bunch of stuff, man. Yeah. We have another exciting project which Big Name has just attached themselves to, like Big Name.
Oh wow.
You know, so we almost didn't believe it, but they want to do it, so that we're setting that up to hope shoot January, February
Something for you to direct, or
no? I've got a great female director that I've plucked out of having done a few short films. The cast members come on because of me and because of us,
yeah,
and because of my trust in the director. But I mean, it'll be great for her. She'll, after that, she'll just go.
I did a Q&A with you the other night, and you talked about
I didn't know we were allowed to say that, in case, because then people kind of, well, they know each other. This is ridiculous. This is a totally biased conversation.
I'm giving this conversation 4 stars. You talked about a film about cake.
Yes. I've had this idea for a long time. Literally, I don't have my laptop. Literally, still on my laptop is the Word document with the title, Cake. I want to do a film about a cake contest. Like, just a nice sort of...
Wait a second. This is something that you've been watching Bake Off?
No.
And you're like, this is zeitgeisty right now.
Really? I've had the idea for a long time, man. Wow. Someone who's not from that environment, kind of getting into that environment and ended up in this cake contest and stuff like that. And there's two versions. There's one that's sort of an American version, and there's one which I mentioned to you the other night, which is a foreign language set in like Portugal or France or something like that, where it's just like someone getting it. I just love the thought of it. I love cake as well, so that helps.
I can see that film.
That film too.
Man, I would love it. Sort of a tone of Amelie. Remember Amelie?
Yeah.
That sort of tone, you know?
Like, yeah.
Not quite delicatessen, but sort of the Amelie tone.
Do you bake? No?
No, God, okay. No. I eat cake, though.
Right.
I'm very, very...
A consumer, but
well-versed,
not a manufacturer.
In eating cake, yeah.
Right.
What's your favourite cake?
Red velvet, mate. All
day. No, I can
not even hesitation,
no,
just straight
sorry,
in.
Bang. All day.
Red velvet, absolutely. I'm going to ask one last thing before we get on to talking about the week's movie news as well. There are a couple of sex scenes in Brotherhood.
Mm.
How do you direct yourself in a sex scene?
So the one with the other, not the wife.
Yeah.
Without giving too much away, that literally is close set, and me and her spoke about it like weeks in advance. This is what we're gonna do, and we literally had it. It was like a dance move.
Yeah.
So we sat down. We're like, right, we're gonna do 30 seconds of Missionary, and then we'll flip to.
I said it to my wife last night.
Doggy. 30 seconds.
Yeah. 30 seconds. You know, I'll try my best.
Best minute of your life, girl. Then we're going to flip. So we literally... They're cracking up at you because they know it's true, right? We literally...
Not from experience.
So we literally plotted this dance move.
Yeah.
Set the camera up in one spot for that one. Everyone cleared out. And then we're like... The first AD's outside and he calls the 30 seconds. So he's go! And on 30 seconds he goes, switch! And we literally switch position. And then he goes, switch! So that was enough so that if the wife watched the thing, she would see. With Shanika... Just directed it as I would direct it normally. Like, Shanika's my friend, so it's like, it'd be like having a scene with you. Like, it's so unsexy.
I'm not suggesting we should have a sex scene.
No, and I'm not suggesting you're unsexy. Just like the actual the actual process of doing it is very unsexy.
This is now officially a closed pod.
Yeah. that's interesting. Because we talked again the other night, because there are lots of scenes as well in Brotherhood where Sam is very angry and very intense, and you said you had to take yourself away from set and get yourself into that.
Yeah, with the emotional stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I just wonder how that works with scenes where you're tackle out, so to speak.
Well, it's in a change purse, isn't it? It's all like,
is it?
It's in a thing that goes. You put the boys in, and then you put the main man in, and then you pull the string so none of it can leak out. Do you know what I mean? And then the girl has a big old hand size sticker.
What?
Over
this
her
is
goodies.
Amazing.
That then kind of goes around like a little thong and just tucks in behind the bum cheeks like that. So everything's all covered up.
There you go. That is something that you've learned something today, Phil, haven't you?
And the girls' one is called a modesty patch.
Uh-huh.
And the boys' one is called a modesty pouch.
Not too modest right now?
No.
Okay. Right.
This moment.
Change purse, I call it.
More of a modesty satchel. Right, let's talk about the movie
His
news.
Is like a modesty sack. He's like, mine's a sack.
I knew it would explode. I knew it would go off the rails. Right. Let's talk about the week's movie news. Phil, what's happening? What's happening in the world of movie news? Let's get more involved in this.
Okay. No.
Yes?
There's festivals happening. I don't know. I was hoping you might
have some movie
news.
No, it's going to
Toronto. You're going to Toronto. There you go.
Today.
Right. So the movie festival's happening. Venice has happened.
Yes.
Toronto's about to happen.
It is.
You're going to Toronto. Tell us about it.
Toronto International Film Festival is one of the top festivals in the world. They select films from around the world, and they've selected Brotherhood, weirdly.
So what does your festival look like, just in a nutshell? You there
festival,
for more than a day,
couple
of days?
I'm there for 10 days.
Oh, wow.
So literally, we have the screenings of the film. They're also showing the previous two films. But I have meetings like from morning to night every day for 10 days, like full up, because everyone from LA and New York flies over to Toronto and produces meet and actors meet, and people set up new films, they sell their films, we have films we want to sell as well, so it's going to be a full on. And then in the evening, every night there's a party. I don't party very much. If my wife's listening, I won't be partying. I will be in the apartment working until my next morning meetings. If she's not listening.
Yeah.
Right.
Parties.
Yeah.
We'll edit that bit out.
Yeah.
We'll bleep out the relevant parts.
We've had the Venice Film Festival this week, and I guess the big story there has been probably the return of Mel Gibson with Hacksaw Ridge, his new World War II film with Andrew Garfield, which he's calling very much an Australian movie shot in Australia, which got a 10-minute standing ovation.
Wow.
That seems like a really long time to be clapping. But it's something that that people have been raving about over there.
Yeah. We should do it. We should stand up for 10 minutes and clap, because I think after a minute you're going to start to get a bit bored.
You would, wouldn't you? Long time. You hear about these standing ovations at Cannes that go on for sort of days.
I think the record at Cannes is 20 minutes. That's why.
What do you do?
That's why I heard.
Is everyone still clapping in those 20 minutes? I mean, you can't be as enthusiastic throughout that clap.
You can't do it. It's ridiculous. Kevin Smith told me that he got a 20-minute standing ovation for Clerks 2 of all movies. But right. I've never seen one at Cannes. I've been to Cannes multiple times, but you know, obviously they don't let someone like me into the big gala screenings. So I've never seen people do that. I've never heard people boo a film at Cannes either. You know the story about Mark Kermode? He was so angry at the film once he ran down at Cannes, took his shoe off and threw it at the screen.
Mark
Kermode, yeah.
That was not Mark.
No, he'll tell you that story.
I heard about that. I didn't know it was him.
Yeah.
But is it the clapping a case of you're clapping and then you're like, I'm done clapping. You go to sit down and something's like, John's still clapping. Yeah. I'll keep going. And then you go to sit down, you see me, and no one's still clapping. I might as well keep clapping. Maybe it's that and it just happens.
Yeah, it's just the embarrassment of being the first one to sit down. It's like, fucking hell, I can't do that. All right. I'm clapping Clerks 2 for 20 minutes.
Don't stop till the oldest person in the room like faint collapses. And he's down. I'm out. See you later, guys.
It's like the Hunger Games, but with clapping.
Jeez, pull the car around.
I'm excited about Hacksaw Ridge. I know that.
I've seen it.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
2 days ago. It's very good. I didn't clap for 10 minutes, but I sat in my seat and watched the credits and waited for Andrew Garfield to come out and do a Q&A. So that's kind of the same.
It is the same, yeah.
Is Mel Gibson in it too?
He's not in it, no.
Mm. Can you say what you thought of it?
I just said I really liked it.
Yeah.
Like, proper good.
You did?
Proper good. So the first half of the film is the build-up and then the war scenes start, and they are unbelievable. Like, they are so real and so vibrant, and it is, like, intense stuff. Mm. And when he starts doing his Forrest Gump rescuing thing, where he's just pulling people out of the off the battlefield, that is some intense shit, man. It's a true story, yeah.
So you think Oscar's for Andrew, maybe?
I mean, maybe, yeah.
Wow.
You can really believe that. Like, it's about the first conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor.
Wow.
So this was a guy who wouldn't carry a gun, but and was like persecuted for it by his by the officers and soldiers around him. But then they took him onto the battlefield because he won his case to go on and wouldn't carry a gun, but stayed around to carry injured people off the battlefield when everyone else had retreated. It was amazing.
Wow.
I'm excited about it, though. I know that that Mel Gibson has had his interesting moments off screen, so to speak. Shall we say that diplomatically? Mm. But as a director, I think he's fantastic.
He's an amazing director, and I can't remember who I was saying it to. Maybe Phil.
Maybe. What was it?
I was saying that it's a real... Oh, actually, I think it was your brother.
Okay.
They're interchangeable. It's fine.
Fine.
Saying, because of Mel's much publicised problems, it feels like we're missing like two or three more films that he might have made, and I think that's a real shame because he is such a talented filmmaker. And Andrew Garfield was saying that he's just so emotionally switched on that he just... he lives absolutely in the moment and understands exactly, you know, what the film needs and what the performances need to be, and he's just so intelligent about it that he is an incredible director to work for. And yeah, it does feel that, you know, we could have had two or three more movies from that guy, and you know, we've been robbed of them somehow just because of his personal problems.
That's a Mel Gibson box set. Mel Gibson movies and, you know, DVD extras of him yelling at people. That'd have been interesting.
Apocalypto 2.
Absolutely.
What Women Want Again.
Very excited by... There's not a lot of movie news out this week, I guess, because Hollywood shut down for Labor Day. But Shanghai Dawn seems to be happening. This is the third in the Shanghai Noon series. So the last one was Shanghai Nights, which came out, what, 2002, 2003?
A long time ago, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe 2004. And so now Jared Hess, the guy who directed Napoleon Dynamite, yeah, he's going to direct the new one with Jackie Chan and Owen Wilson back again. And, you know, I like the first two movies, so I'm pleasantly surprised by this. Noel's not too convinced, I can tell.
I didn't really love them.
Yeah?
No, I didn't really. I mean, I like Jackie Chan stuff, but those ones just didn't sit well with me.
And like the partnership between Chan and Owen Wilson.
I think it was a setting, really. Wow. It just didn't quite work for me.
Yeah. As I've said in the podcast before, maybe because I didn't get the pun of Shanghai Noon for years. I didn't get it.
What's the second one called? Shanghai Nights?
Shanghai Nights.
What's that?
There's no pun there.
Okay, what's the third one?
Shanghai Dawn.
Is there a pun there?
No.
They've got us looking for puns now.
Yeah, so you got High Noon, Shanghai Noon. Mm. So it should have been High Society.
Yeah.
Shanghai Society. It should have been something like that. They should have kept playing on that.
So they should have just switched genres almost.
Yeah.
So keep the two together. So it's two together, but in different types of films.
Yeah, absolutely.
All based around
Shanghai society. Yeah, Shanghai concept.
Shanghai Don Corleone.
Yeah, absolutely. Shanghai God. I don't know what that would be, but yeah. I'd like to see Jackie Chan in a movie like that. That'd be quite fun. So I've completely turned around this movie now. It's going to be rubbish. There, I've decided. What else is happening? Because obviously I wouldn't want Noel to be late for his flight, but let's talk about a couple of other things.
It's not new news, but it's today is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek first being broadcast in the
today?
States.
Today?
The 8th of September.
Fantastic.
Wow.
So happy birthday, Star Trek.
There we go. We have someone who's part of Star Trek.
Yes.
Right here.
For a second, I was looking at John. You were in Star Trek? And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I was actually. Yeah. Your hand direction was all off, Chris. It's a little...
Pointed directly at you. Look at that.
I was like, what?
Mate, you need to go to Specsavers. Look at that.
You know,
it's directly at you.
Glasses, you know.
Yeah?
These days, yeah.
Okay. There you go. Well, I'm glad to have helped.
They're in my case.
Point this out for you. Were you a Trekker before you took on Into Darkness? Was that something that...
I was neither a Trekker or a Trekkie, but I was a fan of Star Trek, and I used to... But I wouldn't go as far as to say I was one of those, but I did watch the Next Generation. The original just kind of... I was just a bit too young to catch the originals. I think I remember them vaguely, but Next Generation, every day. Every day I used to watch that when I came home from school or college.
Yeah.
Number one, engage. Picard, loved him.
I don't think they've got enough credit for how good the casting of the reboot Star Trek movies is.
It was fantastic.
Zachary Quinto and...
Clarkey.
Yeah, you're not in the crew, though. Like, just crowed by...
He could have been.
Just hanging around the back, just fiddling with knobs.
He could have been.
What's that guy doing?
Ensign John, innit? Right, Ensign John, with me. Really? Do I have to, mate?
You got the whole plot going, though, in the sequel, so that's pretty cool.
I was just teasing. Yeah, no, the casting's been great. I think Chris Pine's very... Is it? Yeah, Chris Pine is a very underrated actor.
We're talking about Hell or High Water... today, reviewing it, which is out as well this week, and he's so good in that.
Yeah,
really good.
Very strong mustache.
Really,
very
really
jealous of that mustache.
Very powerful mustache. Is it worth mentioning that Narcos has been commissioned seasons 3 and 4 of Narcos, which seems to be something that people are really into at the moment.
Yeah, what's interesting about that as well is that, as I understand it, season 2,
yes,
Pablo Escobar.
Spoiler.
History doesn't make it.
No.
So they're going to have to switch onto a new target, aren't they? I mean, which is cool. I guess that's the sort of anthology nature of a lot of TV shows now, where they change things around.
Would it mean that they start getting a little more fictional? Or
I think what happens is, and I don't think this is a spoiler, they've been quite upfront about the fate of Pablo Escobar, but the Medellin cartel, suddenly Kylie becomes more powerful, so it's maybe...
Kylie?
Not the Kylie cartel, okay. Run by a vicious young Australian. No, the Cali, the city. It's a sort of a reshaping of the Colombian drug.
I thought that's an interesting direction for Narcos to go. Kylie Minogue turns up in the third season. I should be so lucky.
That was good, man.
Thanks, man. I didn't write that down either. Look at that.
I know you didn't. It was really good.
Doing the Coco motion.
Now that's even better.
Oh dear.
All right, one last thing, and then we're going to let Noel get to his flight. This Hugh Jackman musical, The Greatest Showman on Earth, which is about P.T. Barnum. An original musical these days. La La Land is going gangbusters in Venice. People are loving it. But a big budget, lavish original musical with songs that you don't know. That's a very, very rare thing. But Hugh Jackman's in it. And this week, we've got Zac Efron, Michelle Williams, Zendaya, and Rebecca Ferguson's joined the cast this week.
Which one?
X Factor.
Not Rebecca Ferguson of X Factor, sadly. Who has a new album out in October.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. Big fan of Rebecca Ferguson.
Okay.
What a voice. But the other Rebecca Ferguson from Mission Impossible. So she's in it as well. So
not quite as excited about that, if I'm honest.
Really?
Oh, she's great.
No.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca
was the X Factor girl in a musical. I'd be like, oh, mate, she's done well.
She's got a hell of a voice. She was on Sunday Brunch the other day. I feel like a Rebecca Ferguson stalker here, but I promise you I'm not. Mm-hmm. She's moved so many times, it's hard to keep track. But she was saying that she'd like to act at some point. And I can see that. You know, she's got this incredible Bond-esque, very, you know, smoky.
They all want to act.
All of them?
Yeah.
Name a single, any musician, and
like, yeah, you mentioned, I'd love to get into movies. You're like, yeah, of course you would. Give me some of your millions on your record sales, I'll think about it.
Does it work the other way around? Do you want to get into music?
No, I don't. The hills are alive. I think I can hold a note, though.
That was evidence to the contrary, but fair enough. Do you have any musical talent? Do you play an instrument?
No, I don't. None at all.
Shutting that one down.
Yeah.
I'm excited because I think Rebecca Ferguson is a great actress, but yeah, I agree. I would have preferred to see the other Rebecca Ferguson in this one. That would have been fun. She's awesome. New
also,
album.
Bridget Jones is out. Do you guys not? You know, is that not a new lot?
In 2 weeks' time.
Not out yet.
We talk about it next week. No, you're right. You're right to talk about it though, because it's I interviewed Colin Firth for it. He's one of our guests next week.
It's a trilogy. I believe the second British trilogy.
Yeah.
Oh. What's the first one? Just kidding.
No, right? Starring and Renée Zellweger. It's very interesting. Right, I think we should let Mr. Clark go and catch a flight to Toronto, because we wouldn't want to be, you know, responsible for you being late for all those meetings that you're doing.
Me neither. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
It's been a pleasure. And I promise you, well, as best as we can, we're not going to delete this one.
Oh, yeah, please try not to.
Fantastic. Cheers, Noel. Thanks for coming in, man.
Thank you.
Okay, so Noel has left the building, and as one guest leaves, another arrives. This one is of the pre-recorded variety, though. It's Aragorn himself, Viggo Mortensen, who ever since Lord of the Rings finished, he's carved himself a very interesting path as an actor. That continues with this week's drama, Captain Fantastic, which he plays, shall we say, unorthodox widower, struggling with his large family. We send our Emma Thrower to talk to him. Enjoy.
So we're absolutely delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast our 2009 Icon Award winner himself. It's Mr. Viggo Mortensen.
Nice to speak with you.
How are you?
I have good memories of that night.
Do you?
Not that vague, not as vague as you might think.
There were some big speeches from Russell Crowe. And
yes, I remember that.
Now, as we sit and chat today, there's still a few weeks until Captain Fantastic hits the UK screens. Mm. But the film had such a warm response at Cannes a few months back, and rightly so. So how did it feel to receive such a rapturous response there? Because Cannes audiences can be quite mean, can't they?
Yeah, they can. They'll boo, they'll sometimes walk out, and people argue loudly while the movie's showing. Even.
Yeah.
All of that happens there. We first showed the movie publicly at the Sundance Film Festival, independent film festival in the U.S., and it went really well. It was very well received there, long-standing ovation, and then we were very excited to be invited to be in competition in Cannes. But I was a little nervous about it, you know, when some of the kids asked me, or Matt, the director, so what do you think awaits us there? I said, hard to say. It could go either way. You know, international audience is a different kind of audience, different kinds of journalists and so forth. Plus the fact that they were showing it at 10:30, 11 at night after journalists have seen a few movies that day.
A bit restless.
Yeah, I thought, oh, this could either go really badly or, well, you just don't know.
No.
And it was, if anything, it was even more of a rapturous response than Cannes, as you point out. And the the best thing about it was that audiences, not just journalists, stayed afterwards, and we were out in the street talking with them, and they were really excited and relating it to their own families and, you know, their own society. They weren't saying, well, this is just a U.S. movie or about U.S. society or something. So that was very encouraging, and it's continued. You know, I think Matt Ross won an award for his directing there at Cannes, and we've won several audience festival awards in Europe and the U.S. and very, very happy about it. I'm very proud of the movie. I'm really happy that it's in movie theaters. You know, these days, to see independent movies in movie houses, it's getting harder and harder, you know.
Now, there's that incredible photo from the red carpet where you and the kids all are flipping the bird to the press. Whose idea was that? It's such a good photo for anyone who hasn't seen it.
I guess I have to admit I instigated it, but it wasn't very... they needed no convincing.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we're a tight family unit.
Now, for those who aren't yet aware, Captain Fantastic is the story of your character, Ben, and his six incredibly intellectual children, and they live in their own sort of paradise away from the restraints of technology and conventional schooling. What was it about Ben that really, really spoke to you?
Well, I like that he's flawed. He's a very human character. It has a complex emotional journey, you know, so it was not only one of the best scripts I'd read in many years, but one of the best, if not the best character in some ways that I'd been given to play.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed, you know, just even reading the script the first time, having no idea where it was headed. I liked it in the first few pages a lot, but I had the wrong idea of where it was going. Okay. I had a much more limited idea, it seems like, and I think you feel this when you watch the movie, that this is this father and six kids living in the forest, completely off the grid. You're thinking, well, it's some kind of left-wing utopian fantasy, and they'll be coming up against conservative foes and obstacles and so forth, and, you know, that's fine. And I was looking forward to that. It probably would be funny and so forth. And it is funny, but it's much more than what I thought it was going to be. As you get further into the story, you realize it's really not politically slanted at all. In fact, Ben, the character I play, the father, is where you at first might think, well, what if, you know, he is a fantastic dad. He is Captain Fantastic. Not too far into the movie, you start to wonder if he's not really unhinged and a menace to society, really, not just his own kids. That he's too, you know, he's honest, which is great, with his kids about everything. They talk about sex and death, even the six-year-old. But it's maybe too brutally honest.
Sure.
In some cases, and some of the things that he asks of them physically, some of the extreme, you know, mountaineering and all that sort of stuff, that maybe it's too harsh. It's too much for young kids. So, you go back and forth wondering, is he a really great dad or is he a terrible dad? And the people you think are going to be cardboard cutout antagonists or villains in some sense, or the bad guy, the grandfather in particular, who's very conservative. When you meet him, he's played by Frank Langella, first of all, so it's very well acted. But he and his wife, the grandmother played by Ann Dowd, they're very sensible. They're very reasonable. It's obvious they love their grandchildren. They love them as much as I love them. And a lot of the things that they say make sense. You kind of say, as an well, yeah, I was thinking that, actually. Ben, that was a bit much, you know, what he did with the kids and this, without giving things away.
Sure.
So it's very balanced, and it speaks to the value of communicating and listening to people that you are not initially interested in, or you may want nothing to do with, or you've already prejudged as being stupid or ignorant or, you know, wrong in their ideas. I mean, this is a problem in society now, isn't it? You know, when you cut yourself off as a country from other countries, or you cut yourself off in terms of race, religion, class. So I think the movie speaks to that, and without being political. And I think it's one of those movies that people will remember, you know, in the way that certain movies mark a time. If you're talking about U.S. movies, I'd say movies like Easy Rider at the end of the 60s or early to mid-70s movies like Taxi Driver, Network. These are movies that you remember from a certain time. And I think right now in the U.S. anyway, I don't think things have been as polarized in society as they are now since the late 1970s, you know, in many ways. And I think Captain Fantastic will be remembered as a movie of this time very much.
You were saying about Frank Langella and that the grandparents are very sensible. However, he does fire an arrow at you. Was that real? How does he actually fire an arrow at you is my question.
Yeah, but it wasn't as close as it looks.
No.
You know, so he wasn't as close to hitting me as it looks like in the movie. I mean,
just slightly.
Yeah.
You're paired with the most infectious bunch of young people in this, one of them being our very own George Mackay, who we're very fond of over here.
He's a really good actor. He does a fantastic job. He plays the eldest of the six children. There are three boys, three girls, ranging from six to, in the movie, you know, even though he was probably 20, 21 at the time, he was playing an 18-year-old. Yeah, he's wonderful in the movie. Really does a great job.
And one of my favourite scenes that you share is that sort of impromptu music session around the campfire.
Right.
Is that how you all bonded before you started filming? Is that right, with your music?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, the director fortunately got permission from the producer to bring the kids early. I got there early anyway because I wanted to work with Matt on the home site where we live in the woods and help putting in the garden and sort of. I brought a bunch of things in a truck and say, well, if you want to use these things, they would work here. You know, bicycles, canoes, blankets.
They just had
bags.
Hanging around.
I just brought them from home and plants. You know, so we could plant a garden that was at a stage. You know, where it really would be a vegetable. Garden at that time of the year. But we had 2 weeks of intensive group training and some individual training with the kids before we started, which was proved to be invaluable, mainly in terms of bonding, but also the skills you have to see on screen. You know, the rock climbing, the martial arts, you know, jiu-jitsu that we do, the yoga, you know, catching animals, and the girls even had to learn to do, you know, skin them and dress them out, bagpipes, all kinds of music.
Them,
yeah, but
did.
I don't play that well. I play pretty badly.
Just to wake the kids up.
Yeah.
As far as it goes.
Certainly I would wake anyone up the way I play them. And the music was part of that as well. And we would get together and jam. It was a really good way to get to know someone.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be a musician. You don't have to be good at an instrument. You can make music together, whether it's a drum circle or you're playing different instruments. And we quickly got to know each other in that non-verbal way, understand each other. So by the first day of shooting, we were really tight as a group.
Now, you told my colleague Phil a few years ago that you had some issues with heights when you were filming at Helm's Deep doing with Two Towers. Now, you've obviously got a bit of a cliff climbing bit in this. How was that this time around?
Wasn't crazy about that either. I mean, it's necessary for the movie, so of course you're going to do it.
Yeah.
And when all these little kids, the young actors, are swinging about on the cliff face and laughing and having a good time, feel kind of stupid if you don't at least give it a shot, do your best. So that was, I probably had to do more acting in that scene than in some of the other ones, where I had to pretend I not only knew what I was doing, but that I really liked it, enjoyed it, and was comfortable hanging from, you know, just a ledge way up above the ground. Yeah, it was a short day, and one that I was glad that was over with quickly. Definitely.
Considering you were the one that was meant to be the calm person teaching them without spoiling anything, someone has a bit of a slip, don't they?
So. Yeah. The voice of calm and experience, and really I was the least comfortable up there, but it worked. You can't tell.
What was your favorite memory from that shoot? Because the surroundings it's set in are just absolutely stunning.
Well, I did like the landscape that we shot and all the landscapes we were in. And it changed a lot. It was ambitious as a schedule for an independent movie. First of all, you have little kids who have limited working hours, but we also had to move constantly from location to location. And some of them were hard to reach. You know, the ones that were in the forest or in the mountains.
Yeah.
There's so many scenes. I mean, I don't want to ruin anything you see in the movie, but there's a lot of scenes that I really loved. I particularly like the early part where we actually live in the forest. It was great to be there.
Like running through it and...
Yeah, just being there, you know. And the couple weeks before when we were doing that training period, I ended up staying out there. So I'd be by myself there at night.
Okay.
And, you know, because I was working on the garden and other things and just trying to make it feel real, like a real home.
Yeah.
Because it was important to the director, it was important to all of us that you really believe these people could live that way. And then that way it contrasts more when they leave the forest and deal with the so-called civilized society. It's funnier and sometimes more thought-provoking. It's more shocking when you see their family model in contrast with other people's.
Absolutely. I rewatched The Road last night after quite a while, and it made me sort of laugh how the father won't let his son touch the alcohol there, but he quite freely passes it around to his children around the table.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that.
How do you think Ben would fare on the road?
I think he'd do well.
Yeah.
He's actually probably he's better equipped than the character in The Road, because the character in The Road he's someone who obviously lives in a suburban setting before the sort of end of the world, you know, happens. And in terms of living off the land and making shelters and all those sorts of things, I think Ben is much better equipped for that.
Yeah. Do you think he'd draw the line at cannibalism, though?
Not sure.
No, I'm not sure.
I mean, I think if he found somebody who's fresh actually dead. I don't think he'd kill to eat, but I think he wouldn't waste a good meal if it was lying there on the side of the road.
Absolutely. Well, the kids know how to skin.
That's true.
They've got the skills.
They could.
It's so refreshing to see a film that is primarily free of screens, because iPads, iPhones, they are everywhere. They're changing how we consume movies now as well.
Well, that's true.
Now, however, a film that you recently produced and starred in was shot on 35mm, right? Which is something that is so rare nowadays. So does the kind of quote-unquote Netflix era scare you? Are you worried about the future of film, or does that kind of excite you?
People will always make movies and people will always watch movies. Mm-hmm. The length of movies, the genres, the way they're shot may change, but people will always watch them and be interested in them, I think, because they incorporate so many artistic ways of expressing yourself. Yeah. You know, it's music, it's dance, it's movement, it's fashion. Sometimes it's poetry. Obviously, it's photography. But yeah, I suppose you can call me old-fashioned, but I really feel like a movie, for it to really be a movie, needs to be seen by people who pay money to go in, however little money that might be, to go into a dark room and watch on screen a movie of their own free will, sitting there with strangers. There's something about that ritual, about that detachment from your iPad or your home TV screen, that's quite different as a movie-going experience. I love that experience, and I feel that movies should at least be seen that way at first, and then they can be seen in all kinds of ways. But I know that it doesn't matter what I say about that. It is changing very fast. I'm certainly extremely happy that Captain Fantastic is being shown on movie screens and that people are enjoying it a lot. Some movies can probably handle being seen on a smaller screen with interruptions, you know, better than others. I think Captain Fantastic is such an immersive experience.
Definitely.
And it is beautifully shot. To be in there, in this environment, off the grid with his family, and really feel like you're there, I think it's much better on a big screen. So I'm glad it's being shown in movie houses.
Talking of Hauher, it's a film that you produced, and you've obviously produced a few more films. Do you have any wish to direct? Is that something that you are interested in at all, or are you quite happy to stay in front of the camera?
I've written a couple of scripts.
Yeah.
And I have interest from someone to finance one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping I can perhaps do that next year.
Can you elaborate at all, or is that strictly secret?
I don't want to jinx it. It's not at all like Captain Fantastic, but it is a family drama, I guess.
Okay. Captain Fantastic might sound like a superhero film to many people. I'm sure you've heard that so many times, but it absolutely isn't. Are the Marvel and DC worlds one that interest you at all?
Yeah, and I know a lot of your readers are really interested in those. Sometimes they're made well. I mean, understandably, when a movie costs hundreds of millions of pounds or euros or dollars to make, there are going to be many more cooks in the kitchen in terms of producers and people, you know, having opinions of how the script should be, who should be cast, and, you know, all that. And you tend to, you know, people want to recoup that investment. So understandably, they tell stories that you've generally speaking seen before. Put them in a different time period, change the costumes, update exactly the same stories in some cases. And most of the time, it's not very original. It doesn't leave you a lot to talk about afterwards. It's not like with Captain Fantastic, where you can debate the movie and have a lot of fun talking about it and go see it again and then see more things in it. It is what it is with most of those sort of comic book movies. But obviously, there are people that can make huge budget comic book movies or fantasy movies like Lord of the Rings, like some of the movies Christopher Nolan has made, where there can be original thinking and good acting and thought-provoking storytelling. That can happen. It can be done. That's a little harder, I think, though, because there's so many chefs in the kitchen and people are so cautious about veering off into completely new territory storytelling-wise.
I'm trying to imagine what a Cronenberg Marvel film might look like.
He'd probably make a great one. He'd probably make a fantastic comic book movie if he wanted to.
Yeah. And finally, besides Cronenberg, you've worked with such a huge range of directors, you know, Ridley and Tony Scott, Jane Campion, Brian De Palma, just for starters. Do you have a mental bucket list of sort of other directors that you would like to work for?
I don't. I don't have plans about directors, stories, characters, or anything like that. And I don't try to do one. You know, there's a term, there's a saying that people use sometimes in the movie business where they say, well, I'm going to do one for them and one for me, meaning you do some big budget movie and then you do an independent movie to keep your, I guess, your price up or your visibility so that you can then help get small movies made. I've never approached it that way. I just read scripts regardless of where they're from, what the budget is, And the first thing I asked myself, is this a story I'd want to go see? Is this, you know, in the movie theater? And if it is, then is it a character, I assuming it's offered to me, is it a character I think I could do justice to, you know, that I could help tell this story?
Yeah.
That's all I look at.
Well, Captain Fantastic is something that everyone should see in movie theaters. We love it, and so nice to talk to you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay, that was Viggo Mortensen. We'll be talking about Captain Fantastic later on in the review section, for it is now time for the review section. We're going to kick off with the week's big release, and by big, I mean in terms of budget, because it didn't do very well in the States. And it's not that good, is it? Ben-Hur.
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 Oh dear, Ben-Hur.
Oh, Ben-Hur.
Yeah, Ben-Hur, it's a well-known story, an oft filmed story. This is the sixth version, I think. Yep.
It's two silent versions. One of the most famous stories ever, you could say.
Yeah, the famous version, the one that won all the Oscars. That's one of the previous versions. There's an animated version, there's a miniseries, and now there's this new one. And, well, the story is Ben-Hur bores around Jerusalem being bland and hateful. And
that's what it says in the log line. That's how they pitched it.
His adopted brother, who doesn't have a very nice life, really, like he's not really meant to feel part of the family. He goes off and makes something of himself, then comes back to Jerusalem a few years later after being in the army and you know, seeing some shit, man, and says to Ben-Hur, Ben-Hur, like Pontius Pilate's coming to Jerusalem. Can you please, you know, like help me out here? And if there are any zealots you know about, can you like tell me about them? And Ben's like, I could help you, but I'm probably not really going to in any meaningful way. And in fact, he's actually harbouring a zealot, nursing him back to health. And that zealot takes a pop at Pontius Pilate from the house of the Ben-Hurs. And
OMG.
Yeah, and then Masala, the brother, is like, well, I've got to do something about this. This is I asked you to help me. You didn't help me. You are actually harbouring a zealot. I'm going to have to arrest you and make you a slave. And that cues off his big 4-year quest for revenge, which eventually culminates in a big chariot race.
The chariot race.
Now, the famous chariot race.
Yeah, because this is directed by Timur Bekmambetov.
It is indeed.
Director of Night Watch and Wanted, a film I still enjoy to this day, and then the absolutely dreadful Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. This seems more in keeping with that quality-wise.
Yeah, I mean, one of the very real problems is that it's very hard to sympathise or even like Ben-Hur for a huge amount of it. And you have to think he is the person to support, and that his brother Masala is the person, you know, to boo and hiss. And it's very difficult to come to that conclusion
almost
if you're watching it.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of the film is poorly conceived, really. And from, you know, Morgan Freeman has a line which is, you know, well, you can't fight them on the streets, but there is somewhere you can fight them, the circus. And he means the chariot racing arena, but of course, that's not how it plays in the moment. In the moment, it plays like, you know, elephants riding unicycles.
Tiny bicycle,
and and it just, it's a difficult film to love. It's a difficult film to even get very excited about. Even when you get to the big action sequence, it's been done so much better elsewhere in the famous Ben-Hur, which was, you know, a real chariot race to all intents and purposes, not one, you know, coated with CGI, and you know, it felt real. And then, you know, The Phantom Menace had a pod race, which was, you know, very much inspired by the chariot race, and that at least had some drama in it. You knew who the people were, who, you know, the bad guys, the good guys, who was fighting against each other. You had some sense of drama. But in this, Masala and Ben-Hur are kept apart for so long. Ben-Hur's at the back and Masala's at the front, and it takes so long for them to actually get so they're actually fighting with each other at, like, neck and neck, that bit of this 10-minute sequence is over in a flash. And you know, it's really hard to just engage with it overall. I didn't really like Ben-Hur very much.
No, I'm getting that.
What about the performances, though? I mean, you have Toby Kebbell, who's also... I always think he's very, very good. I think he's been pigeonholed by Hollywood, I think, to becoming a bad guy in movies, and I think there's more to him than that, to be honest.
But to be fair, like, he is, as Masala, he is someone who, like, you can start to sympathise with Masala in this version, and that's never really been the case before, I don't think, in any Ben-Hur. Well, let's be fair, I've seen one other Ben-Hur. I've not seen the animation, I've not seen the silent versions, but... You know, you don't sympathise with Masala in the Charlton Heston version, but you do in this one because, you know, he seems to be, you know, a put-upon guy who went away and tried to make something himself and then comes back and is forced into this terrible position by the fact that, you know, Ben-Hur's a dick. And then it's very easy to sympathise with him, and Toby Kebbell is, you know, a likeable actor.
Whereas Ben-Hur is played in this film, not by Charlton Heston, but by Jack Huston, one letter out, but yeah, not quite the same. I mean, Chuck Heston, one of the greats, full charisma, full of, you know, that, I've talked about it in the podcast before, that great 50s leading man swagger where you're sucking your stomach in because you can't be arsed to go down the gym, that sort of thing. Whereas Jack Huston, you know, I don't know, he's a good actor, good looking guy, but is he Chuck Heston?
I mean... The charisma that you talk about is not present in Jack's performance here.
Yeah,
I'd hate to completely write off his entire past career and future career based on this one role.
He's been very good in other things like Boardwalk Empire, and
here he is insanely bland. And and you do not root for him particularly. You're like, well. You got what's coming to you.
It's quite short, isn't it, this one? Because they've traditionally been films that stretch across bank holidays quite comfortably.
It's 2 hours.
This one's quite a pithy...
It's short compared with the Heston version, but, yeah. I mean, it has been told in 12 minutes. The first silent one is about 12 minutes long, I think.
You're sort of leading Ben-Hologist. Ben-Hologist.
I basically looked them all up before I went to see it.
So, Huston, we have a problem. It Ben hurts.
Mm. Yes.
Okay. Two stars.
Two stars.
Two stars for Ben-Hur. Which is not good.
Not a recommendation.
In a week filled with good films.
Yes.
Good films. And one Phil's going to talk about. Phil loves this movie.
Yeah.
Phil would marry this movie if he could. Hell or High Water.
Hell or High Water. I would marry this movie.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really like this movie.
Tell us
about
it. I mean,
listen, I love westerns, and this certainly is, you know, it straddles the kind of the crime thriller heist movie and the western genres really elegantly. And David McKenzie, if you've seen Start Up, the Jack O'Connell, Ben Mendelsohn prison drama, you know that he's got a really good handle on character and interior work. Here, this is much more of an exterior film. It's set in the sort of the dusty, I think it's Texas. The fallout of the financial crisis is kind of afflicting the landscape, and that's something that's you're led into very early on, in a subtle way, as you see this car rolling into a bank car park early in the morning. Out pops Ben Foster and Chris Pine in balaclavas to knock off the bank, and it turns out that they are. Basically, the banks themselves are after their property, and they've got a certain amount of time to raise the capital to pay off the outstanding mortgage payments before they lose it. What you find out quite quickly is that the land that they own is actually a gold mine of oil. So an oil mine, really, more than a gold mine. But they have this clever plan where they're going to just take the till money. They're not going to go big into the vaults. If you've seen any heist movies before, you know that once you go into the vaults... bad things invariably happen. So they're just going in and out, taking small denomination notes and doing basically a road trip around the area. In hot pursuit, Jill Birmingham and Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges is that kind of like cop on the verge of retirement. It's a bit of a trope, but he brings something fresh to it. He is kind of pleased with himself in this film in a really lovely Jeff Bridges-y way. And Jill Birmingham, they have great chemistry, the two of them. So it's like double two-hander, this. The two brothers and the two cops in pursuit. And Mackenzie has just done a great job. It's scripted by Taylor Sheridan, who did Sicario, and it's got great, great dialogue. They really fizz off each other. And if you love those kind of Western, because I think the West is a great kind of crucible for America as it is, as it was, and now as it is. You know, the post-Vietnam mm-hmm, era, you had mm-hmm. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is a touch point for this one, a real sort of sense of weariness and cynicism creeping in. And this has that kind of like post-recession vibe too. It reminded me a little bit of like Last Picture Show, Hard, those kind of films, The Misfits, that kind of era of dusty American life. It's got great set pieces, great performances. I thought Chris Pine was, for me, the surprise MVP. Mm-hmm. Thought he was absolutely terrific in this film. You see range that I haven't seen before from him, stuff that I didn't know he was capable of. Ben Foster does what you'd expect.
Such as? Juggling?
He does a bit of juggling.
Mm-hmm.
Unicycle?
He doesn't unicycle.
Okay.
No. But he's funny and he carries it and he's charismatic and he's quietly quite menacing. Mm-hmm. I haven't think we've seen that before from him. The brooding menace.
Maybe one or two films, but
not the juggling.
Not the juggling.
You give me that.
I'll give you that.
So we're giving it 4 stars, and great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've been looking forward to seeing this film for a long time, and I would recommend it heartily if you like. Even if you don't, look, don't overstress the Western side of things.
How Coen-esque is it? Because it feels in the same ballpark as No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, there's definite parallels, I would say. You have this Jeff Bridges character who's quite redolent of the Tommy Lee Jones character in a similar position, sort of slightly half-heartedly in pursuit. It's not got the kind of the dark seam of the Coen brothers.
It doesn't have an Anton Chigurh.
It doesn't have that. No, it does have stakes, and the stakes laid out early on, and the stakes, as it turns out, are pretty profound. But it doesn't have the kind of. I mean, in some ways, I preferred it to No Country for Old Men, and that's a bold statement.
Whoa!
No Country for Old Men, I think, has probably more layers that you peel off the more times you watch it. But this film is just very, very accessible, very fun, thrilling at times, very well paced and beautifully shot. And it's all underpinned by a really fantastic Taylor Sheridan screenplay. He's a very talented writer, as anyone who's seen Sicario knows. There are parallels. They make a great double bill. But the Coens are interested in their own thing. And I think Mackenzie's interests are slightly different, perhaps a little bit more grounded in America as it is now, whereas I think maybe with No Country it's more of the Coens love that idea of the universe playing games with their characters, and this doesn't quite have that, but it certainly has, you know, a real sort of catch-22 conundrum at its heart, which I think will speak to a lot of people in times of struggle, and it feels like a very current film as well as one that's pretty timeless. So I would recommend it heartily. As I say, 4 stars.
4 stars sounds like you go 5.
I wouldn't close.
Go on, Phil.
The juggling swings it.
No, 4 stars.
It's, no, I mean 5 for me is it's not quite there, but it's pretty close.
So you wouldn't marry it, but you would.
I wouldn't marry it, but I would swipe left or right.
I don't know.
Anyway, I'd see it again.
Okay, see it again. I'd take it out. I'd have a second, maybe.
I'd take
third
it in Nando's, and I would allow it at least one side, probably two. No, but I just sound awful. What an awful man. That's the best I can do on a date. Anyway.
Got a couple more movies to get through because it's a hell of a week. Next up is Kubo and the Two Strings, which is the latest movie from Laika, who are the American stop-motion animation masters. Not to be confused with Aardman. They're the guys behind Coraline and most recently The Box Trolls. Johnny.
Yeah, Kubo and the Two Strings. We really loved this. It's about a boy, Kubo, and he is sort of a street performer in this small village, but has to get home before night every day. And it's becomes clear why the one time he stays out, and that's because his aunts appear, and his aunts have been sent by his evil grandfather, the Moon King, to steal his eyes. And it's a very chilling moment when his aunts come. They are, for what you know to be puppets, they are two chilling puppets.
Well, I thought Coraline was pretty scary. Yeah, so it was Box Trolls at times. They have this sort of dark edge to their work.
Yeah, anyway, so him staying out after dark triggers this this quest. So the appearance of the aunt, this triggers a showdown, and his mother saves him, and he is left without her, with just a monkey for companionship. It used to be a wooden monkey toy that he had in the cave with him as a boy, and now it's a talking monkey who is here on his quest, and his quest is to find three pieces of a magical suit of armor, which he then is going to use to fight the Moon King and win. And on the way, he also meets a giant beetle, played by Matthew McConaughey, who's very funny.
Great.
And they go off on this quest together. And yeah, it's a really, really lovely film. It's beautifully animated, and I think the one thing that really struck me was just the movement of Kubo's hair. I was captivated by this, honestly. just sit there and just watch his hair move for an hour and a half, and you'll be just as happy as you can be. It is a lovely thing. But yeah, it's incredibly effective. It has a number of very spooky moments, the moments when the ants first appear, already mentioned. But there's also this underwater sequence with these giant eyes, which is incredibly odd and kind of terrifying. Just giant eyes, man.
Yeah,
under
I know.
Water.
It's pretty crazy.
And these have a hypnotic effect on Kubo, and he is like dragged towards them, and you know, and unless he's saved, presumably towards his death. But of course, you know, it's a kid's film as well as an adult's film, and this is doesn't happen here. He doesn't, the eyes don't get him.
The eyes don't get him. I don't know what it is with Laika and the eyes thing, because Coraline had that as well, didn't it? The other mum wanted...
With the buttons.
To replace her eyes with buttons.
Yeah.
And this has got basically the plot.
Stealing
is someone
eyes.
Trying to remove someone's eyeballs, which is quite terrifying on a profound level.
Yeah.
You've got the giant underwater eyes that you've talked about. But I think... I love their films. I think that the stop-motion animation is just breathtaking. You know, you see the because one of the other things Kubo does is he creates origami. He has a sort of magic gift, doesn't he? He can create origami and make, and the origami sort of is animated itself to become, to tell stories. And it's sort of an animation within the animation. And it's, I just literally just, you know, that dumb sort of goofy look you have on your face when you're just totally captivated by something. And it felt like that, especially in the first sort of half an hour when it's setting the story up. It's just breathtaking, the sort of imagination, and as a film about telling stories as well, I thought it was particularly brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it's startling to look at, and actually if you stick around for the credits, there's almost a behind the scenes sequence of how they did one of the action sequences, which is a fight they have with a giant skeleton. There's a sword stuck in its head, and they have to retrieve it. And you see how they did it, and it's actually quite a big skeleton in real life. It's not small like you see Wallace and Gromit being. It's a big thing, and there are people, you know, moving around it and working and moving it, and just the craft that goes into it.
The giant skeleton is reminding me a little bit of Harryhausen, the Ray Harryhausen stuff, and it has lots of Japanese sort of folk story elements to it. The samurai, the idea of the samurai, and the ronin, and the scarab beetle plays that kind of role of the guy that wants to return to his samurai glory. Felt that the quest part itself was just a touch truncated, like it needed a bit more.
This is what we were talking about beforehand, and this was my only real problem with the film, and I wonder if this had been, I suppose, better developed, then maybe it would have gone the full five. But yeah, it didn't really feel that they were following clues to find this treasure. They stumble upon this first piece of the arm, which is actually the sword, right? They just stumble upon it, and then they go across a big lake, and that happens to be where the next one is. There doesn't seem to be any sort of national treasure style, this is the clue and this is how to find the next bit, and then there's a real something that they're following. It just seems that they're just like so that was my one quibble with it, but Otherwise, it's a really lovely film. I was captivated by it.
Fantastic. And 4 stars in for Kubo and the Two Strings. It's a hell of a week this week. Interesting fact about Travis Knight, who's the director of Kubo and the Two Strings, and he's the CEO of Leica, and he's the owner of Leica, and he's just the grand poobah of American stop motion animation. He is the son of the co-founder of Nike, Phil Knight,
right. And
he is, shall we say, fairly wealthy.
Flash,
so it's interesting
flash.
That he chooses, a lot of rich kids flounce around the world and they party on someone else's dime and they just have a great time. And this guy, incredibly talented, incredibly focused, and he is keeping an art form that not many people really gravitate towards these days. He's keeping it alive, along with, obviously Artman over here. And more power to him, I say.
I say too.
More power to those millionaires. Right, we don't have a lot of time left because this podcast, we recorded on a Thursday, usually goes up on a Friday because of unavailability of editors, shall we say. Tomorrow, Friday, we have to get the podcast up today, I've been told.
Why don't we say because of incredible efficiency and speed?
No.
And skill. We've got it up early.
No.
No?
No.
Depends how you spin it, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I just don't think anyone will believe us.
No.
That's true.
Also because,
the thing with
it goes up on Friday. Everyone knows that's when it goes up, so we have to explain why we're putting it up a day early.
Okay.
So there we go. So we don't have a lot of time, but there's three other films worthy of your attention this week. Phil's going to talk about two of them.
Super
Anthropoid
fast.
And Captain Fantastic.
Yep.
We talked about Viggo Mortensen was on the show.
Yep, but pretty different propositions. Both very, very good. Captain Fantastic is Viggo Mortensen and his wife. Viggo Mortensen leads his kids, who presumably haven't seen the road, into the wilderness with him. And unfortunately, tragedy strikes the family. The mum dies, and it's about sort of picking up the pieces. And there's a road trip element to it. It's a lovely watch, beautifully acted across the board. We've given it 4 stars. There's so much to get your teeth into at the cinemas this week, and this would definitely be up there with any of them as a sort of slice of American indie bucolia. And the second one is completely different to that. It's Anthropoid, which, as you might imagine, is a sci-fi monster movie. Is actually a World War II thriller starring Cillian Murphy and Jamie Dornan as a couple of Czech paratroopers, or Czech special forces, or Czech assassins, effectively sent in by the British to assassinate Reinhard Heydrich, who someone memorably be described as the third most senior Nazi dickhead during the Second World War. It's an astonishing story. It's been told before on the big screen, I think in the 70s, Operation Daybreak, and it's being told again in a film called HHHH, which is in production still. So it's one of those weird ones where there is two at the same time about the same subject. But this one's more of a straight kind of assassination thriller, which is interested in these two guys, these real people, real heroes, who had to, they formed attachments with women who were sort of initially their cover, and then they blossom into more of a romance. And as they prepare, and in Jamie Dornan's character's case, they overcome their sort of terror of the act of assassinating this incredibly senior guy. So when the assassination attempt comes, that's sort of halfway through the film. It's quite sedate up to that point. It sort of lays the groundwork for a very sort of potent final third, I would say, after the assassination. It kind of escalates into more of a Saving Private Ryan style kind of shootout, I guess. It's a bit sort of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance, because what they actually did was hold themselves up in a church, and the Nazis found them, and it kicked off from there. So the film depicts all of that. Doesn't show much of the training prior to, it starts with them parachuting in, so you don't see a lot of what came before. You pick up the characters as you go. It's a 4-star film for us.
Mm-hmm. Gripping tension.
It's tense, yeah.
Gripping tension.
It's for me, it was slightly on the lower end of the 4-star spectrum, but very watchable, and certainly you come out feeling, in the same way that you felt with Private Ryan, the final third of Private Ryan, or maybe even the beginning of that film. You have that sort of like, it's quite disorientating. It's quite a sort of visceral experience, and it's a good one. And the two of them are very, very good together. Cillian Murphy and Jamie Dornan I'm not sure about the sort of the Czech accents in English. I don't know if that's not a bit distracting. I wouldn't mind if they all just spoke in English accents personally, if that's the way they want to go down. But, it's probably a minor quibble. It's shot by Sean Ellis, who made Metro Manila, which is highly acclaimed film shot in the Philippines in 2013, and he's clearly a talented guy. He's been trying to make this one for a long time, and here it is this weekend, 4 stars.
There we go. Imagine if it asked you to talk about that film at length.
Oh shit, I really went on a bit, didn't I? Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Yeah,
fine.
I was supposed to do a recap. Should I do like a 5-second recap instead?
Yeah, go on.
So you're going to talk about it for even longer then?
No!
By doing this as well.
Anthropoid, it's a real-life war story about the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich starring Sean Ellis. So directed by Sean Ellis and starring Cillian Murphy and Jamie Dornan, and they're really good, and it's 4 stars, and go and see it if you haven't seen the other films that are out this week. They're also good.
Okay, which also includes Don't Breathe, the horror film from Fede Alvarez, the director of the Evil Dead remake. This one's a home invasion thriller where three people rob a house belonging to Stephen Lang, who is a blind man. They think he's an easy target. Turns out he is absolutely anything but. And it's full of tension, full of thrills, full of spills. 4 stars for that one. Very interesting, controversial ending, shall we say.
Ooh. So many stars this week. So many stars.
So many stars and so many films that we can't really talk about in depth. But there we go. 4 stars for Don't Breathe. 4 stars for everything except for poor old Ben-Hur. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, sponsored by American Airlines. Don't forget, tickets are on sale for Empire Live, 23rd to the 25th of September, including the live podcast, although I believe that may be sold out. But you never know. People will give returns and stuff. But yeah, that's at the O2 London. Tickets are on sale now, empirelive.com. All very, very exciting. Join us next week, of course, for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by, as I said earlier, Colin Firth, star of Bridget Jones's Baby, and Sam Neill. He's back in the booth. Do you see? And he's star, of course, of Hunt for the Wilder People. It's going to be very, very exciting. What a lineup that is. Until then, it is goodbye from Johnny.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
Thanks, of course, to Noel Clark for joining us through most of the podcast. That was a lot of fun. And it's goodbye from me. One last note. Helen wasn't on the podcast this week, of course. Her grandmother, Phoebe O'Hara, passed away this week. So our thoughts are with Helen. I'm sure your thoughts are with her as well. And we're dedicating this podcast to the memory of her grandmother. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.